people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar. Pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, arr, gar, gar.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, May 13th, 2010. One killed, four injured in Gaza, and troops detained 12 Palestinians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One Palestinian was killed and four other members of his family were wounded on Thursday at dawn when a power generator exploded in their house in Rafah City, southern Gaza Strip. Muhammad Taha, 26 years old, died to severe burns. His father and brothers sustained light wounds, doctors reported. Taha was trying to install a power generator in his house when the accident took place, the family said. Residents in Gaza have to depend on private power generators to get electricity. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the Gaza-only power plant, destroying half of its generators. The other half has to shut down 12 hours a day due to fuel shortages. Israel tightened its siege on the Gaza Strip in June of 2007, rendering the 1.5 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave lacking much-needed food, fuel, and medical supplies. Also on the Gaza Strip, around 105 Palestinian patients, stranded families and students managed to come back into the Gaza Strip on Thursday via the Rafah crossing. The Rafah terminal at the borders with Egypt, the only way for Palestinians in or out of the Gaza Strip, was closed for 37 days till it was open today. Egypt says that Rafah terminal will be open for 3 days starting on Saturday, May 15th. Rafah crossing was being run by joint Palestinian-Egyptian forces overlooked by EU monitors according to an agreement between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israel in 2005. When the elected Hamas movement outed Abbas' forces from the Gaza Strip in June of 2007, ending months of infighting, Egypt closed the border crossing, opening it only a few days a year for special cases only. Elsewhere, the Israeli military detained on Thursday 12 Palestinian civilians during pre-dawn invasions targeting a number of West Bank communities. Palestinian sources reported invasions in Jericho and Jordan Valley villages where troops searched and ransacked homes before taking the 12 men away. The Israeli military announced that all detained were handed over to the Israeli Secret Service Shin Bet for questioning. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Barnoura.
Human rights organizations in Israel, especially those that defend the rights of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, are facing a new threat to their operations since a bill was introduced in the Israeli Knesset, or parliament, that could prohibit foreign funding for these civil society groups. Among the groups targeted are Rabbis for Human Rights, Coalition of Women for Peace, and Gisha, which defend freedom of movement for Palestinians, focused especially in Gaza. The group has filed lawsuits heard up to the Israeli Supreme Court, trying to force Israel to allow fuel and other supplies into Gaza, which has been under an Israeli blockade since Hamas took control of the territory in 2007. The bill aims to prohibit the registration of, or to close down, any existing non-governmental organization if there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the group is providing information to foreign entities or is involved in legal proceedings abroad against senior Israeli government officials or Israeli military officers for violation of international law or war crimes. The largest financial supporter of human rights groups in Israel, the New Israel Fund, has been targeted by the Israeli right as being responsible for a majority of the critical information gathered in the United Nations Goldstone Report, which found that Israel had committed war crimes during its 2008 Gaza invasion. Sari Bashi, the executive director of Gisha, is a graduate of the Yale University Law School and spoke at the school in April about the interconnection of human rights in Israel and Palestine.
Both the erosion of human rights for Palestinians and the erosion of democratic protections for Israeli human rights defenders have to do with a crisis in values, a crisis of democratic values, of universalistic values. A democracy that is maintaining a military occupation, which is obviously non-democratic, cannot maintain these Chinese walls. It's going to spill over in ways that are going to be detrimental. And it always has. But now it seems to be more extreme. There's always been a pendulum that swung back and forth between the government's ability to tolerate dissent and to protect the rights of freedom of association, freedom of speech for people who criticize the government. But the last year, since the Gaza war, it swung in one direction in a way that I have not seen before. I have not seen it this bad, and it doesn't show any signs of swinging back anytime soon. So I don't know where we are right now. We're in some kind of transition. What am I talking about? Well, the readings talked about this law that would restrict the ability of human rights groups to get funding. That initiative is taking place in a context of a coordinated government campaign against human rights groups within Israel in the wake of criticism over the Gaza war. There's been a media campaign in which government spokespersons have spread misinformation about human rights groups, characterizing us as a fifth column, calling us a strategic threat, traitors, calling us agents of European anti-Semites, and making it seem as though we're operating secretly, when actually, as human rights groups, we believe in transparency, so we try to operate as transparently as possible. The foreign ministry has created a special unit that is designed to combat Israeli human rights groups. There have been attempts to obstruct funding, to prevent our ability to get funding from abroad, either through legislation making it difficult or impossible, or through political moves, where the Netanyahu government has actually approached different European countries who fund human rights groups through these kind of neighborhood programs in support of human rights and said, don't fund groups that criticize us. And also the use of the tax law. The tax law is being used to do what I would call harass human rights groups. This summer, the tax authority tried to remove our tax-exempt status because we defend Palestinians. I'm glad to say so far we've survived that particular attempt, but it's not just us. There are other groups that are being targeted as well. There have also been arrests of peaceful demonstrators, of Israeli Jews. When Palestinian demonstrators, Palestinian citizens of Israel, were arrested, the government could couch that as a security threat. Now they're arresting Israeli Jews as well, where it's not about a security threat. They say, you know, this is an illegal demonstration. There's no violence, but we're not going to let it take place. And, you know, these are all symptoms of what I would call a crisis of values. Israel is self-defined as a Jewish and a democratic state. And that would mean that you have particularistic values, values of protecting the Jewish people, and you have universal values, which are democratic values, international law, human rights, which belong to everybody by virtue of being human. And there's always been some kind of uneasy tension and balance. We're now shifting in one particular direction. And it creates a challenge, I should say, for human rights groups, because not just in terms of our legal activity, but also in terms of our public advocacy, we're fighting for communicability. We're promoting values of universal human rights, of individual rights, of democracy, of freedom. And increasingly, the values that are being promoted in the public sphere and in the political sphere are values of particularistic self-defense. It's us against them. The them is dehumanized. And even people who look like us, even Israeli human rights groups, are part of the them if they criticize. On the one hand, there's a crisis. On the other hand, I'm actually a little bit optimistic because we're in a transition. And I don't know what we're transitioning to, but I think there are opportunities here, if we can do it right, wake people up inside Israel to say, look, you and I may not agree about what the policy should be in the occupied territory, but maybe you're also worried that I'm getting arrested. And maybe you can understand that there's a price to these particularistic values about something you care about, because maybe you care about Israeli democracy. And maybe we can get that conversation to expand to human rights.
That was Sari Bashi, Executive Director of the Israeli human rights group, Gisha. For more information, visit the website at gisha.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
Wednesday, Afghanistan. Two occupation soldiers were killed, one by small arms fire, one by a bomb. Tolofar, Iraq, today. Three suicide bombers struck a soccer game, leaving at least 10 dead, according to preliminary reports in this Shiite-majority town. Baghdad, yesterday. Two Iraqi soldiers were killed and seven more were wounded in an improvised explosive device blast in southern Baghdad, a police force reported to Aswat al-Iraq news agency. Diyala province, yesterday. An improvised explosive device went off on Thursday morning, targeting the chief of the Diyala police, Colonel Salam al-Zuhira, while on duty in central Bakuba, damaging his vehicle, a police source told Aswat al-Iraq news agency. Mr. Barack Obama, now's the time to remove the U.S. troops presence is fueling the violence. Bring all the troops home today.
Retired Marine Sergeant Hermogenes Marrero is waiting for his day in court. The retired Special Forces Marine claims he has contracted colon cancer and Lou Gehrig's disease as a result of his exposure to the chemical weapons he guarded for the U.S. Navy on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Sergeant Marrero is the lead plaintiff in a massive class-action suit brought by the citizens of Vieques against the U.S. Navy. The American government used the island as a military base and bombing range from 1941 to 2003. Marrero was stationed on Vieques for 18 months in the early 1970s, where he was exposed to toxic chemicals like Agent Orange and napalm. The retired Marine told a news magazine In These Times, "I did not know how dangerous these chemicals were, because it was on a need-to-know basis." For years now, residents of Vieques have been diagnosed with cancer at a rate 30% higher than the rest of Puerto Rico. Citizens on the island also have triple the rate of high blood pressure and an increased incidence of diabetes. Federal District Court Judge Daniel Dominguez must decide whether or not to move forward with the 2007 lawsuit filed by 7,000 Vieques residents. Meanwhile, the U.S. government claims it has sovereign immunity from the lawsuit against the Navy. In 2005, the EPA designated Vieques a federal Superfund site for toxic materials, despite the fact that napalm, Agent Orange, depleted uranium, arsenic, and other hazardous chemicals remain on the island. The Navy continues to assert that nobody on Vieques was harmed by its activity.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. On Saturday, the 8th of May, the U.S. military's weapons display in the mall shut itself down for hours in the face of an anti-war protest organized by Code Pink Women for Peace. Every year, the military displays engines of war such as tanks in the mall on Mother's Day weekend, and Code Pink called this a violation of the original meaning of the holiday. Protesters marched at about 3:45 p.m. to the military fair, calling for a celebration of life and peace, not weapons and warfare. A group of about 40 women peace activists and several dozen more children and male allies arrived at the military weapons exhibit to find it already shut down and fenced off public access in anticipation of their protest. This, of course, was an automatic victory, with the military choosing to forfeit. The protesters organized by Code Pink continued to protest for over an hour, despite thuggish police warnings about, quote, not having a permit to sit. With their bluff called, police made no move to back up their tough talk with arrests, again forfeiting the victory to Code Pink. On the 11th of May, protesters outraged by BP's mammoth oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico marched from the Department of the Interior to the White House demanding a total end to offshore oil drilling. A number of participants showed up on bicycles despite the rain. It's raining out, not at all pleasant for riding a bike, yet that's how a number of participants arrived at the protest.
No fish on the sea, no birds on the shore, we don't want big oil, no more. No fish in the sea, no birds on the shore, we don't want big oil, no more. No fish in the sea, no water is making us sick. Make it clean, make it quick. Oil in the water is making us sick. Make it clean, make it quick. Oil in the water is making us sick. Make it clean, make it quick. Oil in the water is making us sick.
Despite several attempts to stop the flood of oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico from their destroyed Deepwater Horizon oil platform, British Petroleum has not yet succeeded. Their first attempt, using robotic submarines to shut down valves at the wellhead 5,000 feet below the surface, failed. Then the company tried to lower a 100-ton containment dome over the well, but ice crystals inside made the dome buoyant and unstable. Now, BP is considering using a smaller dome or injecting the well with golf balls and shredded car tires to clog the oil well. There have been initial reports of crude oil from the disaster washing ashore along the coast, and several birds with oil-stained feathers have been rescued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Sun-Herald newspaper of Mississippi reported that since BP's oil rig exploded on April 20th, the Obama administration has granted at least 27 waivers to oil and gas companies, exempting them from carrying out environmental impact studies of oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico. This, despite a pledge from Obama to prevent more damage in the Gulf and the announcement of a temporary halt to offshore drilling. The U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is calling for the Minerals Management Service to be broken up, so collection of oil royalties and safety inspections of offshore drilling are separated, responding to critics who say the agency is riddled with conflicts of interest. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with BBC TV reporter Greg Pallast, who investigated the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill for the Chukog Native villages of Alaska's Prince William Sound. In his recent article, Slick Operator, the BP I've Known Too Well, Pallast examines British Petroleum's disturbing pattern of behavior, both in Alaska and during the company's current drill platform oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
I was in charge of the investigation into fraud, possible fraud in the grounding of the Exxon Valdez and the disaster. And what I concluded then, this is 20 years ago, after 3 years of investigation, was that while Exxon had its name on the boat Exxon Valdez, the real culprit, the real corporation that slimed over 1,000 miles of Alaskan coast, was British Petroleum, whose name is nowhere. And here's exactly what they did. This is a company that commits continuing fraud. I don't say that lightly, especially because I work in Britain under British libel laws. For example, in Alaska in 89 when the Exxon Valdez hit, it wasn't the fact that the ship hit that it slimed or that you had a blowout in the Gulf that everything gets covered with oil. You can contain the oil. That was British Petroleum's job in Alaska. They had promised in writing that they would have the stuff you need to control a spill, which is, by the way, not rocket science, Scott. It's real simple. When a ship goes aground and breaks open, a tanker, or oil well blows out, you surround the whole area with rubber sheets, with rubber skirts called boom. And then you bring in skim boats and you suck the stuff out. You may drop some dispersant in to break it up, but basically you surround it and remove it. That's what British Petroleum promised to do. But that requires a lot of equipment, and that equipment may be simple, but it costs millions and millions, and it adds up to billions and billions, and that they wouldn't do. So, for example, in Alaska, the Exxon Valdez ship hit at Bligh Reef. British Petroleum had promised to actually have the rubber skirting, the emergency supplies, on Bligh Island right there, and you can practically reach over from the ship and grab the emergency equipment. The problem was the emergency equipment wasn't there. They signed off and said it was there, but it wasn't because they figured, who's going to check? You know, among the icebergs and, you know, Indians up there, the natives. And then they were supposed to have emergency response crews, same in the Gulf. You have to have a 24/7 crew to put that rubber out. It's just like a fire department. You know, there may not be a fire every minute, but you have a full-time fire department, right? The natives were hired as the full-time response crew and given the equipment to do it, including helicopters. And then they decided to save money, and they fired all the natives. So when the Exxon ran aground, the natives were standing on the beach at Tetitlik Village watching the ship hit the reef. They could actually see the ship coming closer and closer to the village, which is right near Bligh Reef. It hit the reef. They could have been out there, grabbed the rubber skirting off of Bligh Island. If they had the authority and equipment, they were still on the payroll, and the equipment was still there, as it was supposed to be. The Exxon Valdez would have been surrounded in a few hours. You would have never even heard about this grounding. It might have been a one-day story. We wouldn't be talking about the Exxon Valdez 20 years later. They did the same thing in the Gulf. They were given a waiver for the Deepwater Horizon having a special plan. They didn't need one because they did have a fairly decent plan for all their Gulf drills. The problem is it was a complete lie. It was a fabrication. It was nonsense. They said they had all this rubber skirting and the skimmers, and they didn't have them.
Greg, is that a violation of law? Is this a strict requirement that they have this equipment ready to go in the event of a spill, and did they violate the law?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know this stuff of like, oh, we didn't expect this. What do you mean you didn't expect it? First of all, you're supposed to expect it because the whole point of an accident is that you're supposed to say what can happen. What's the worst possible accident? And they had a worst possible accident scenario for their other Gulf wells. So where was the boom? Where was the rubber skirting? The U.S. Navy was able to get contractors to bring out 7 miles of rubber skirting within hours of the U.S. Navy being given the job.
Well, Greg, as you point out in the article, a lot of the lack of government oversight on safety, health, and environment really began in a very harsh way under President Ronald Reagan and continued under Democrats Bill Clinton and Al Gore when they were in office. And this oil spill and the lack of really strict government requirements for safety devices to prevent a spill like this in the Gulf have been waived or just ignored. The results are apparent right now in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes, so we have this anti-regulatory fanaticism, which is spread through both parties. It was Al Gore, Nobel Prize-winning bearded Al Gore, who was the one who headed Clinton's deregulation committee, which basically cut the heart out of environmental regulations and other regulations. And obviously, we know about Clinton's deregulation banking. It's all of one piece. And by the way, when you look at those, you know, the snake dancing going on at those teabagger parties, where does the money come from? I tell you right now, it's coming from oil interests. The big money behind the teabaggers is Koch Industries, which is an oil and gas company owned by the Koch brothers. And it's all about loosening up the environmental regulations on oil.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast. Read his articles online at gregpalast.com. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, An Armed Madhouse.
You may have heard of Huntington Life Sciences, or HLS, notorious for killing 500 animals a day, testing products like bleach and Splenda. What you may not have heard is that they are over $70 million in debt and would not exist today if an investor called Fortress Investment hadn't showered them with loans and extended the loans when default appeared certain. On the 13th of May, protesters disrupted a green capitalism conference at the Baltimore Convention Center, where Josiah Lindsay, vice president of a green energy hedge fund run by Fortress, was scheduled to speak.
500 animals died today. The problem of the city is too great. 500 animals suffered in pain. Josiah Lindsay is too great. 500 puppies murdered today. Josiah Lindsay is too great.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
That's the literal truth. Here's what things sounded like when undercover investigators caught Huntington Life Sciences' so-called researchers punching beagle puppies in the face. This sort of thing has a way of seriously infuriating people. Here's how protesters responded at that Baltimore Green Capitalism Conference.
There was a banner that was attached to 30 green and black balloons, and it's inside the convention center right now, like hovering over, around over by the third floor, right in front of the Josiah, right in front of the room. And when everyone exits down the escalators, everyone from this Green Capitalism Conference will see the banner that was dropping.
Nice. It took the cops at least half an hour to respond, at which point they told lies about needing a permit to use a bullhorn, tried and failed to demand ID, and finally threatened people with arrest unless they backed up to the sidewalk.
And that will save up.
That will get you locked up.
I just
understand that. That will get you locked up.
How's it going to get you locked up? It's perfectly within our...
What's the
law in question? What's the law?
What is the law in
question?
We need to get moving. People are going to jail. What is the law? It's some bitches that are popped. I told you to listen to the deputy. Take it over there. But you cannot block the sidewalk. You cannot use the megaphone. You cannot. You heard what I'm saying, okay?
All that police aggression didn't even work. Protesters pretended they were finished, headed down some one-way streets to lose the cops, waited until the cops were gone, and returned.
We got out of there. Everyone's safe. No arrests were made. What happened was around 3:30, we packed it up and went around the corner, went through some one-way streets. We did like a fake wrap-up, and then we came back at 3:45 when the session was letting out.
Ooh.
And then the cops were gone, so a few of us rushed up to the convention center, up to the windows, and did a shout-out, and then we started chanting. And then we were there until like 4:10 or so. And then the cops showed up again, and we were packing up as the cops were coming in. When we were back, like, you know, we were using bullhorns and things like that.
But they were pissed.
Yeah, they were pretty pissed. We saw the convention center people up on the skywalks. They were, like, calling the police like crazy and saying they're back. They're using bullhorns. And it turned out that the banner was up over an hour, and they had to get this little truck with a lift on it that lifted all the way up to the ceiling to get the banner that was inside.
On top of all else, a Native American participant in the protests called out Josiah Lindsay who is African-American, for investing in research descended from forcible experiments conducted on Black and Native American people in prior centuries by white supremacist colonizers.
This country, this nation, so called, is well known for testing on the supposed inferior. Since 517 years ago, when Europeans landed on this continent, humanity emphasized raping and killing off the indigenous people. They thought the indigenous people were also inferior, just like you and your company take animal parts to death. And yet, they tested on indigenous people just like you slaughtered these animals right here in these pictures. Just by linking Britain's theaters of white supremacy, this domination, this exploitation and speciesism. Just by linking, you're continuing this by investing in this. Of course, not only do the indigenous people hung by their heads and their skin was ripped out just to see how the savages bled to death, they did the same thing to Africans when they brought them over here. The silent African and indigenous people were cut open down the middle of their chest, just like you showed these primates and these puppies inside of hunting to my sciences. So we will continue to invest in this. We don't know what they're continuing the legacy of. They're continuing the legacy of colonialism. They're continuing the legacy of white supremacy. So if that makes you proud, Josiah Lindsay, if you want to keep rocking that fortune family, then go ahead. Because you're going to drive yourself into the business if that's what it takes.
Now, mind you, that doesn't come from your stereotypical white animal rights activist. That comes from a Native American animal rights activist who participated in a May 13th protest at the Baltimore Convention Center against a green capitalism convention that included Hosea Lindsay, a representative of a green energy hedge fund run by Fortress Investments, which is a company that has kept Huntington Life Sciences afloat. Fortress, no matter where you go, no matter where you speak, protesters are going to find you. Because for those who invest in Huntington Life Sciences, there's no sleep for the wicked.